warm welcome to Animal Voices. Today is Friday, June 20th, 2014. My name is Alyssa Ray. I'm joined today in the studio by Cynthia Ganatra.
Hello.
And big thanks to Kelly for helping out on the controls.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us today. Today we have a really special show for you. So, Cynthia, I know you are an outspoken advocate for animals. What kinds of actions have you participated in?
In general?
Yeah.
So I've done demos. So outside different places like the slaughterhouse or different businesses that, you know, use fur or use the humane meat myth to sell their products. I've done leafleting, tabling. We've done movie screenings, and I've done workshops off the top of my head. Yeah, just awesome. Some of the things I do. And the radio show.
Yes, definitely. We're involved in quite a lot. Most of it is on the right side of the law. So we're mostly involved in advocacy and education and outreach legal demonstrations and that kind of thing, protests. So our guest today, Will Potter, was actually the FBI showed up at his door after a legal leafleting event. And it's just a really interesting story. Have you read his book, Green is the New Red?
No, I haven't read his book, but I've seen him talk. I've seen his TED talk, and I've seen a few other interviews he's done, and I follow his Facebook page. And so I feel like I know him, but I really need to read his book.
Yeah, it's a really excellent book. Came out in 2011. Again, Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. And he talks a lot about the invention of the word eco-terrorism. It was invented by corporations who wanted to protect their profits. So how does civil disobedience and, you know, legal demonstrations and leafleting, how does that come to be seen as terrorist activity? So he talked to me earlier this week, and we're going to play that interview later in the show. So please do stay tuned. It's an excellent interview, and so honored to talk to Will Potter. He's an outstanding advocate and investigative journalist. He's involved in a Kickstarter campaign right now. It's going to be funded on July 9th, so lots of time to donate to that. You can check it out. It's about drones and how he can expose what's going on at factory farms with drone photography and video. It's pretty exciting. Well, you know what? I haven't been on the show for like 5 weeks.
We missed you.
It's really strange. It's a whole new studio. And it feels really good to be back. And I was away doing a course up at SFU through SFPIRG, the Public Interest Research Group up there. And they offered a course on workshop facilitation for social and environmental change makers. So there was about 12 to 15 people around, you know, in their 20s and 30s mostly, who are dedicated to different causes. And we learned over 5 weeks, a 50-hour course, we learned all about different kinds of oppression and how they're all connected, and how when we're doing our events and demos and outreach, how we can not harm other movements. So, and how we can have our workshops and events and demos be the most accessible they can be to everyone in the community. We don't really realize how privileged we are, that we are, you know, we don't think about sometimes that we are able-bodied, or, you know, that some people can't fit in the seats that we have, or that, you know, that if we have events where there's places where there's stairs, then you're limiting access to people who are in wheelchairs, and the importance of offering like ASL interpretation if you want to do events so that deaf people can be included. So that's how we can grow our movement, is by opening the doors as wide as possible and looking at what our limits are. It was like really, really amazing, like hands-on learning. And I'm so glad I did that workshop, and I'm so glad you guys all covered for me while I was gone.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. Is there any kind of one main thing that you really got out of the workshop?
Mostly, I think I am now very aware of checking my assumptions about where people come from and what they're about and what they might be struggling with, because a lot of things are really invisible. Like, you know, people of color might not look like people of color. Indigenous people might not look indigenous. People with disabilities, they might not look like they have disabilities. And like, and people, you know, we assume people's genders, and the importance of always asking gender pronoun preferences and not assuming what someone is just by how they look. And so I think that was the biggest work that we did week after week, was to just show, like, you can't ever assume what someone is or where they're at or their social position or what they're struggling with just by looking at them. Yeah. So yeah, it was really interesting. I feel like I have kind of new eyes.
Wow, that's awesome. I'm looking forward to doing more workshops with you with all this new knowledge. That's great.
And tell me what you've been up to.
What I've been up to, well, I've been busy because I've been preparing to leave for Los Angeles tomorrow. I'm there for 1 week for training because I got a new job.
Yay.
I am the new communications manager for Mercy for Animals Canada, which is pretty exciting. So I will now be employed to do work for animals, which is really exciting. I'm really, Mercy for Animals has done some great work. Obviously, their investigation that just came out in the BC Dairy farm here in Chilliwack. So I'm just, really excited. I get to go there for training. So I'm going to the Mercy for Animals USA office, where I'll meet with some of the people there. So I guess Nathan Runkel and Ari Solomon, who's done a really good video. He does that, I guess I probably can't say it, but Bleep Vegan Say, which is a great video, which I always find funny because I say a lot of those things. I'm really excited to be part of the team. Everybody who works there has been so welcoming and nice. And today they posted on their Facebook page, which I felt really special. And so, I'm really excited to work with them to help, you know, uncover all the stuff that happens. People see what goes on in farming. So,
That's exciting. And I wonder if your work at Animal Voices helped you get that job.
I think so. I definitely think so. I think, you know, doing this work, we're volunteers here, but we spend so much time and so many hours on the show researching, doing the best we can to keep you updated on what's going on. So I'm definitely looking forward to staying in touch, obviously being part of Animal Voices and using that work to kind of intersect with each other.
Definitely. And what else did we want to mention?
We went away somewhere last weekend on Sunday. A few of the Animal Voices crew was there. I think three of us were there. We went to Pig's Peace Sanctuary. Just over the border, close to Seattle in the States. And there was a group of, I think, like 12 of us that went, and some of us had been before and some of us hadn't. So I hadn't been before. And so the people who hadn't been before got to go on a tour, and the other people started volunteering right away, which was really nice. So you guys did a lot more work than we did. We did a little bit of work in the end, but we got to feed the pigs and meet the pigs. And there's, a great video. Actually, UBC animal activists, they posted, a video. Darren Chang had taken a video and of us feeding the pigs, and it's amazing. And Alyssa, you had done a show with them as well, so you should look up the Pigs Peace Sanctuary trip.
I did a 14-minute radio documentary about my last visit there, and I'm so glad that it was organized that a crew went down there to do work, because they need lots of help. There's about 200 pigs there.
So in the news, in Nova Scotia, so Canadian news, Nova Scotia veterinarians voted against a ban on declawing cats. So the Nova Scotia vets have voted not to ban declawing cats, a procedure that keeps pets from, they say, scratching people's furniture. Declawing was a routine procedure as little as 15 years ago, but it's become increasingly controversial in recent years due to the pain during the recovery and the psychological harm to cats. Some vets see it as cruel and unnecessary option and refuse to do it at all. And then some vets think that it's okay to do because they believe that these cats will not find homes otherwise, which... the SPCA, somebody from there says, the process of declawing a cat involves a removal of the first joint of a cat's toe. So if you were to equate it to a human, it'd be like amputating the first joint on your finger. I thought that was quite horrific to have.
A few months ago, Tim and I did an interview with the Paw Project. It's a new film about declawing. It was so eye-opening. I never thought about it. And just showing all these x-rays of these ingrown, like, super painful, pus-filled, like, it's just so sad that people wouldn't adopt cats because of that. Obviously, public education needs to happen to... Have you seen those little claw?
I was just going to talk about those. I don't know much about them, but they said another alternative is a product called Soft Paws, which is a plastic cap that are just put onto the paws so that they can just have those instead. Is that the same product that you're thinking of? Yeah.
So cute. And they come in different colors and they look like nail polish.
Oh, cute. So yeah, I would obviously hear Animal Voices. We encourage you to do that and do not claw. So decloss, unfortunately. Hopefully that will change there in Nova Scotia. So a little update with the dairy. So Saputo, producers of dairy products, say it's no longer accepting milk from Chilliwack cattle sales, a BC farm where 8 employees were caught on video beating cattle. The move comes after Mercy for Animals Canada released an undercover video last week showing dairy cows being whipped and beaten with chains and canes, as well as punched and kicked at Canada's largest dairy farm. It also showed cows suffering from open wound and injuries and being lifted by their necks with chains and tractors. 100,000 people have signed a petition calling Saputo to take action. Since Saputo learned about the animal abuse, they said that they're going to work towards changing it. So I didn't know this, but Saputo actually does not have dairy farms. They just process the milk. Mm-hmm. So anyways, they're saying that they're going to work now with the BC Dairy Association and the BC Dairy Council. I don't know what that will do exactly, but I do know that they said that they stopped the milk the first day, but then now they're already accepting milk from Chilliwack cattle sales. And the SPCA is still investigating. They're talking to Kuman, who owns the dairy farm, and he said he had no idea what was happening. Mercy for Animals is saying that's untrue, that the investigator went and spoke to the managers, and the managers knew what was happening, and they didn't do anything about it. So that's kind of, you know, you often hear this, where the owner always says that this is an isolated incident, but time and time after, you know, Mercy for Animals goes undercover to random farms, and they always see horrific things happening, because unfortunately this is what happens in this industry. This is standard practice, and this is how these animals are treated. Kuman, however, from Chilliwack Cattle Sales, says that they're talking to the SPCA and they're thinking of actually putting those video cameras in, which I think is interesting. I don't know much about what's happened with that in Europe, but I know that they have video cameras in there. Maybe people see what happens in dairy, they will stop drinking dairy.
Yeah, it's interesting that people are talking about it, but I think a lot of it comes down to welfare, like, oh, it's just those people that hit the animals, and it's like, well, no, wait, dairy itself is really, really cruel, and it can't be not cruel.
Yeah, but I was talking to Mary Chris this morning at the Chicken Vigil, and they had a booth at Car Free Day, and she said that a lot of people had come over to Liberation BC booth and were asking about dairy, so she said it was a really great way to engage with people and get them to know what happens and that this is standard practice, so that was really great to hear from her.
People are thinking about it. Yeah. And so in other news, it was announced on Tuesday of this week, sadly, but not surprisingly, Stephen Harper announced that the Northern Gateway Pipeline is a go. So there's a really interesting article posted on the Fur Bearer Defenders blog by local activist and advocate Dr. David Steele. He's with Earth Save Canada as well. And the article is called "Pipelines Are Bad for Animals." And of course, we humans are very much at risk from these pipelines and the tankers. And wildlife is along the pipeline route and at the tar sands are just really will be like obliterated and in so much danger. Of course, there's huge 25 to 30 meters around the pipeline are just totally destroyed, and that's going to really harm caribou, bears, wolves, and the tailing ponds, of course, at the tar sands we've all heard of. So I just wanted to share this short clip from the Unistoten camp about their stance on pipelines.
Harper is legal. Canada is illegal. The province and the federal government is illegal because they don't have jurisdiction in our people's territory because we've never signed no treaties. This land is still unceded, and we proved in the Delgamuukw Stayaway that this is our territory, and they have to get our consent before any projects go through. And they tried to get our consent, and our chief said no to their projects. So no means no. And what Tsuwedan law applies to these, they can go ahead and try and put their project through here. They will be considered trespassers and will enforce Wet'suwet'en law against any trespassers. You bring any equipment on here, it's going to belong to us. You'll be walking out. you try to bring any forces, we're more skilled in the wilderness than they are. So we're not afraid of the Harper government. We're not afraid of anybody that's going to try and forcefully put their project through our territory when we've already said no. And our numbers are quite high right across Canada. Indigenous people probably outnumber settler people. So you can guarantee if there's an uprising in one community, especially something with a bigger project like this that's going to impact the whole world with the global warming, you're guaranteed you're going to have a lot of upset people right across Canada, not just here, because this impacts everybody. So we had people make vows that they will shut down major highways to impact the Canadian economy if Harper government's going to ignore the Indigenous people.
And we're still here. We're not going anywhere. The camp is still here. There's people who are resisting. There's people showing up every day. The numbers are growing. There's numbers growing in the surrounding towns. Supporters are repositioning themselves in the surrounding towns to help build up more local support. There's people in the cities who are mobilized now. They've gone through a lot of training. They're still holding more training workshops. There's individuals all over the world that have pledged to do what they can to help us. This war is far from being over. We're going to win this one, and we're going to win it decisively.
Mob meets a militant, bonds become resilient. Got times and the symbols in along a long river, then go through the life of different band. We soon.
So in light of more talk about a direct action and civil disobedience and people taking risks to speak up for the environment, and also in light of the undercover investigation of farms, I thought it was a great time to talk to our next guest.
Will Potter is an award-winning investigative journalist based in Washington, D.C. His work focuses on the idea of eco-terrorism, the idea that the terrorist label can be applied to actions that negatively affect the profits of animal or earth-harming businesses. He was in Vancouver recently to give a TED Talk called "The Shocking Move to Criminalize Nonviolent Protest." He wrote a book in 2011 called "Green is the New Red," an insider's account of a social movement under siege. He joins us today to talk about activist repression, movement building, and his plans to use drones to expose what's really happening at factory farms. Thank you for joining Animal Voices today. We'll talk about drones and ag gag legislation later in the interview, but before we jump into that, let's start with some background. I'm really interested to hear how a simple act of animal rights leafleting led to a visit from the FBI.
Sure. So my background is in newspaper and magazine reporting, and I was working at the Chicago Tribune covering shootings and murders and all kinds of horribly depressing breaking news. And it really wasn't what I went into journalism to do. And I mean, I was just kind of leaving at the end of the day feeling like it didn't have any positive impact in the world at all. And it was also just kind of making me personally feeling pretty hopeless about the whole thing. And I'd done a lot of activism in college, so I decided to go out with a group hanging leaflets on people's doors about animal testing. You know, as a journalist, I couldn't be out there in protests or organizing or anything like that, but I thought it'd be a safe way to do something positive. And we were arrested for that. And, you know, the charges were all dismissed, but, of course, the important part of that story for me was that a few weeks later, some FBI agents knocked on my door and made a series of threats against me about how if I didn't help them by infiltrating protest groups and animal rights and environmental groups, they'd put me on a domestic terrorist list. And, you know, in a lot of ways, looking back, that was kind of the start of a very clear journey in my work of becoming obsessed with this issue and how people that were leafleting could be threatened with a domestic terrorist list and everything else that's come in recent years cracking down on protests.
So So you weren't necessarily targeted because you'd been involved in lots of animal rights activism and organizing in the past. Can you talk a bit more about why they targeted you?
I mean, well, it's always difficult to know because there's what the FBI and law enforcement says, and then there's what they're actually thinking and whether this is kind of a cat and mouse game or what's going on. But my read of the situation is that they were quite blunt in saying that the reason they were talking to me is because they thought I had this promising career. I had a good job, in their words, at the Chicago Tribune. My girlfriend at the time was applying for PhD programs, and they threatened to make sure that she didn't receive funding for those. They said they knew I had a Fulbright application pending, and they said they could make sure I didn't receive that. You know, they knew all kinds of details about, for instance, my parents having to co-sign on the apartment that my girlfriend and I had because we didn't have the full money for the down payment. All kinds of details that really circled back to them seeing me as having this kind of professional path, and therefore I should be more willing to work with them and not, in their words, you know, throw everything away. And I think we see that theme repeatedly within how law enforcement approaches different individuals to pressure them to cooperate. I mean, it's this use of fear of that, you know, if you don't work with them, that you're going to put yourself at risk, that you're going to jeopardize some other aspect of your life. And in this case, they saw that kind of professional path that I was on and tried to use that to manipulate me.
Yeah, the counter-terrorism actions. Seems like their motive is to instill terror in people and instill fear. And I can see how that that really kind of worked on you, but also really motivated you to take action. Now, let's go forward a bit to what happened in 2006 in the U.S. Can you explain that a bit?
So these tactics in the persecution of protesters as terrorists had been escalating in a lot of ways over that period of time. And I'd been seeing people who I was friends with and who I really cared about being prosecuted as terrorists for their nonviolent protest campaigns, seeing grand jury subpoenas being issued across the country, and then the introduction of new legislation called the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And this is a law that expands a previous law called the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, and it takes a law that was already vague and already overly broad and makes it even more vague and more broad. The Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act includes language about how protest becomes terrorism if it includes a loss of profits of the corporation that was protested. And according to supporters of the bill, it also includes nonviolent civil disobedience if that disrupts the business operations of the company being protested. And I used to work at the American Civil Liberties Union, and through colleagues there, found out about this hearing and was told by them that they were going to offer my name as a potential witness because really not many other people in the country were even paying attention to this stuff at all, and I had been writing about it. And I was invited to testify. And at first I saw it as this honor, you know, to be able to talk about my work, and I quickly realized it's just a political spectacle. Democrats and Republicans both supported this legislation, and I was told to only raise minor objections because it had bipartisan support. And during my testimony, I instead chose to call for the complete rejection of the law as unconstitutional and a threat to basic First Amendment rights.
If something is found to be a terrorist act under this legislation, what does that mean for the lengths of the sentences of people?
That's part of the danger of this legislation, is it really does a couple of things. It takes things that were already crimes, for instance, stealing animals from laboratories, or at the most extreme, acts of arson in burning empty buildings or trucking equipment, delivery trucks or something like that. And it makes it more of a crime based on the politics of the people who take the action. So in other words, it singles people out if they are animal rights activists for enhanced penalties and being labeled as terrorists within the prison system and facing much harsher penalties because of that. And the second type of a threat that it poses in my mind is that it creates new crimes. It creates this idea of animal enterprise terrorism, and that is created by this section of the law, and it's incredibly vague and broad, and it becomes even more vague and more broad when you're talking about this idea of conspiracy, which has been used against political activists for decades and decades when no other law is able to stick, and it's arguing that activists are part of this conspiracy by supporting illegal actions or speaking out publicly in the name of a controversial cause. So that's really the two levels that the legislation is a threat on. It's creating new penalties and enhanced penalties based on people's politics, and then also creating new crimes as well.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of in the criminal justice system, I have heard some criticism of your book from some engaged in prison abolition. I'd like to hear your thoughts. Animal and environmental activists are arguably rather a privileged group. Those activists tend to ignore other activists in racialized and marginalized communities and movements when they need prisoner support. How do you respond to the criticism that perhaps works like Green is the New Red exacerbate the invisibility of heavily oppressed activists and frame some of the most privileged activists as the most repressed?
I mean, I would like to see any substantial evidence of activists acting in that way. I think in some ways a response like that is geared towards more of the success that I've seen in raising awareness of this particular issue and treating that as somehow downplaying other issues, and that couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, I focus on the criminalization of these social movements in particular because of my personal experiences and connections with those movements, and also, like I was saying, really because nobody else was focusing on it. But I'm really clear in my work to emphasize that focusing on one issue does not mean in any way saying that other issues are not important. And there's plenty of room, and I encourage people to be outspoken and involved of the interconnectedness of all of these struggles. For instance, when I write about communications management units, I was exposed to those secretive prison units through animal rights and environmentalists being in prison there. But I take great pains to emphasize and to build relationships with other communities who have been affected. I mean, these prisons overwhelmingly house Muslim prisoners who have been disproportionately targeted since 9/11. I think it's a really mistake to perceive the increased attention on one really horrible aspect of our culture among many, singling that out as somehow worse or deserving of more attention. That's just not how I perceive my work at all.
Yeah, thanks. And do you have any specific ideas on how we might be able to build coalitions in prisoner support and prisoner abolition with other movements to attack kind of the fundamental root problem of criminalization? Have you seen that in action at all, or do you have thoughts on that?
I have, and I think really the foundation of that has to be humility, of not approaching any of these issues as if, whatever we is, we are under attack and we need help, so let's tell other people to come help us. Rather, approach it as we're experiencing things that lots of other movements have also experienced historically and also in a contemporary sense, and let's try to learn from each other. In practice, I've seen that carried out through animal rights and environmental groups holding lectures with former members of the Black Panther Party, through the American Indian Movement, civil rights groups who have experienced many of these tactics. I've spoken on plenty of panels like that as well that have been, in my mind, really successful, even though it's just in some ways a starting point to that dialogue. We've also seen some great work with animal rights and environmental groups and anarchist groups speaking out against the targeting of, Puerto Rican independence activists from way back, and also Black Panthers being targeted in renewed grand jury witch hunts. So I think it's kind of cuts to the heart of some of the biggest challenges that are faced in social movements of, you know, how do you carry out your focused work while also being mindful and building those literal bridges to other social movements and building those relationships. And I think that kind of speaks to what we were talking about a moment ago as well. It's a really difficult task, but I think by approaching it with that humility of trying to learn as much as possible from others and offer yourself to help as much as you can, I think that's the foundation and the starting point.
What do you think are the most important things that activists can do to protect themselves and oppose the demonization of dissent?
You know, as a journalist, I really have this unwavering faith in the power of education. And I've seen time and again that I think our biggest challenge is, above all else, that most people just have no idea what is going on. And there are a lot of reasons for that. But, you know, one of the biggest tasks ahead of us is just raising awareness both within social movements and perhaps more importantly outside of them about what is taking place. You know, I think we really underestimate the level of interest and engagement and outrage that the general public has when they are exposed to these issues. And we have to have the courage and, you know, be able to act boldly to take those issues to audiences that have never heard about them before. Beyond that kind of, you know, really big picture look at raising public awareness, you know, I think we can do some things concretely as well in our everyday lives, everything from showing support to political prisoners of all social movements and trying to build relationships through letter writing and holding benefits and things like that, to working in our communities to strengthen the networks that we already have. So if repressive tactics like this do take place, we're better situated to respond to that. You know, and I think the biggest message in response to that I would have above all else is that these tactics are about fear. And in some ways, I think our best response is to acknowledge that fear while also continuing to do our work, whatever that work may be. I mean, if that means continuing to do civil disobedience or protest or letter writing or, you know, lobbying members of Congress, it doesn't matter. But it's just not caving into that fear and letting it silence us.
Back to bringing the issues to the mainstream, you have been quite successful with that. And the book, Green is the New Red, has, of course, gained mainstream attention and accolades. And you're a TED Fellow now. So how has your life changed since the book was published? Has your personal security been affected?
You know, in terms of my life changing, I don't know if it really has. I mean, it's been great that the issues have been getting a lot more attention, but you know, I'm kind of approaching the work in the same way I always have. I'm just trying to build on the successes and trying to take advantage of every opportunity we have to raise awareness of these issues. And TED has been just an incredible outlet for that. I've just been really overwhelmed by how supportive people within TED have been and all the people I've met through doing my TED Talk in person, and also now that it's online, the public response has just been overwhelming and incredibly supportive, so I feel really fortunate for that. But, you know, in terms of what that means for surveillance and, you know, potentially my own work, it's really hard to say, and I think that really circles back to that theme of fear and that we really don't know what's taking place. The little information that we do get about surveillance and how police tactics are operating and targeting social movements are really just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, as part of my TED Talk, I mentioned some documents I obtained through the Counterterrorism Unit and the Freedom of Information Act that showed my own work being surveilled and monitored, speeches and websites and articles I've written. But I'm also part of a lawsuit right now that was brought by a colleague of mine, Ryan Shapiro at MIT, who's suing the FBI to release its documents about me and my book and others as well. And the FBI is arguing that it can't turn any of this over because to do so would be a national security risk. So it's one of those situations where, you know, you don't know if that's empty posturing by government officials, or if they truly do view their files about journalists like me as a potential national security threat if released to the public. So that's a long way of saying, you know, things like that are incredibly troubling to me personally, but I do put some hope in believing that the more attention my work receives, I think the more of a bit of a buffer I have between some of those heavy-handed tactics.
Do you have any trouble crossing borders? For example, did you have any trouble coming into Canada for TED recently? I know I was just doing a little bit of research, and I found that in 2012, Canada listed environmentalists and animal rights activists among other issue-based domestic extremists. I think 2012 was the first time for Canada. I know it's obviously not as heavy-handed as in the U.S., but I'm just wondering if that poses issues for you, like crossing borders.
I mean, that's always a concern, and I've been pleasantly shocked and or surprised when it hasn't been an issue. Canada, in a lot of ways, has been emulating these eco-terrorist tactics that have been going on in the U.S. for quite some time. For instance, you know, there have been many cases I've written about where American political activists have crossed the border and been stopped and detained and interrogated for hours about their activism. And similarly, when activists, frequently not when they leave the country, but when they re-enter the country from abroad, they're often detained and interrogated for hours as well. In my work, I really haven't experienced that. And I did multiple speaking tours in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland, also in Spain, and recently in Australia. I was down there for a month and had no trouble entering or leaving the country. So I think it's another example of just how this rhetoric doesn't really add up in reality sometimes. There's all this posturing and scaremongering, but then at the same time, you know, for instance, I was approved for the TSA PreCheck, which is for, you know, I did it as a kind of a social experiment to see if I could get this advanced security clearance because I travel so much to kind of buzz through security at the airports. And you would think that since I'm labeled by the FBI as this national security threat, that that would not happen, but it was granted. And I think it just kind of shows the how none of these tactics really add up. I mean, there's just so much miscommunication between law enforcement, and this has taken on a life of its own.
Yeah, let's discuss now the what is known as ag gag laws. My understanding is that's what you were discussing in Australia for a month. I guess things are really heating up there around that. Can you talk about your experience with ag gag and what you're doing to fight it?
So ag gag refers to a series of laws that have been passed in the United States that explicitly target photography and video recording of animal cruelty on factory farms and slaughterhouses. And these bills are a direct response to a series of really damning investigations by groups like Mercy for Animals and the Humane Society, Compassion Over Killing, which have exposed standard industry practices in addition to really extreme acts of individual cruelty by some of the workers that have taken place there. And now these laws are spreading to other countries. I did that speaking tour in Australia because the ag industry in Australia is saying in the press, we want what the U.S. agriculture industry has. We want these ag gag laws. We want this protection from undercover investigators and photographers showing what happens on our farms. And, you know, if you think about it, in a lot of ways that completely makes sense because under neoliberalism and global capitalism, corporations really have no national boundaries. And as these industries spread internationally, they can share these repressive tactics internationally as well. And so in this case, these industries are trying to literally pick it up, copy and paste it from the United States into a completely different legal system. And I think that really speaks to the need for us as social movements or as concerned citizens globally to think about these issues globally as well.
Yeah, I'm really excited and interested to see that this issue is really catalyzing a lot of different people and diverse groups who are coming together to speak out against these bills. What sort of response have you seen from social movements and groups so far?
The Australia tour was, I mean, even better than I could have hoped it would have been. I mean, the public response was incredible. I mean, immediately upon getting there, we had major coverage in the Sydney Morning Herald. ABC National multiple times covered the speaking tour. Every single stop, and there were about 13 of them, had major media coverage. By the end of the tour, I was invited to brief members at Parliament House, and it was just this incredible response, and people were outraged, completely outraged, whether or not they have any ties to any social movement, outraged that the industry was trying to keep them in the dark. Now, just since I've been back, the ag industry is really pushing forward and trying to introduce this legislation still. But in my mind, the tour and those tactics have already been successful because it's the first time I've seen efforts like this to organize proactively, you know, to anticipate and share information about what's happening and how these tactics are spreading and to act before it happens. And I think that's really where we have to be moving with these issues. We can't just always be responding to another repressive measure. We have to be thinking proactively and stop it even before it's introduced.
Mm-hmm. One interesting thing I found is in Canada, from what I can see, well, it was mostly the Ontario agricultural sector was saying that enacting similar laws here would be ineffective and run contrary to the industry's commitment to transparency. They go on to say Canadian agriculture should be both farmer and public friendly. So it's like a total different spin of that. They want to open the doors, and they're saying that that's the answer to help build people's trust. What's your thoughts on that?
I think it's a promising development. It shows that perhaps they're learning from the mistakes of the industry here in the U.S. I mean, one survey from the pork industry publications found that over 70% of the industry itself has found ag gag laws as a total failure for them in the U.S. Another study found over 99% of the media coverage of ag gag was negative towards the industry. So, you know, hopefully that reflects that the industry is realizing they can't keep attempting these tactics, and they have to be able to respond to consumer demand and public awareness and change what they're doing.
And speaking of public awareness, I know that you have big plans to bring what's going on farms to the public. Can you talk about your Kickstarter campaign?
Sure. So just last week, I released a crowdfunded project to buy a drone and to document factory farms, and particularly the environmental devastation that they cause. And it was motivated in a lot of ways by these ag gag laws and these attempts by the industry to shut down photography, and also by seeing some really striking satellite images that I'm sure a lot of your listeners have seen as well. A photographer named Mishka Henner used satellite photography to show the runoff and pollution from cattle feedlots and other industrial farm operations. And I just thought, you know, if we can see that from satellite, what else could we see from a drone if we got closer and we had more control over the photography? And the response to it, the Kickstarter, has been really incredible. It was fully funded in just 5 days, which was amazing. And when I started seeing that response, I began working with a lot of photographers and journalists through TED and through other projects and people I've met over the years to think about how we can expand it. So now I've expanded the project as well to make it even better and more expansive in terms of the states that are investigated.
And so how close can you get with these drones, and what kinds of things do you expect to find?
Well, it will definitely be an experiment in a lot of ways. And, you know, I don't know what exactly we'll be able to see, and that's part of what appeals to me about this project in general, is that an investigation like this hasn't been done by journalists before. That being said, I mean, I have I'm doing the project because I believe very strongly that there's an incredibly good chance of seeing that type of large-scale pollution from these facilities, potentially also seeing some of the farms that identify themselves as free-range and humane and all of these different euphemisms that the industry has adopted, and being able to actually see their scale from above and to be able to see if those types of claims are accurate. I think there's a lot of potential here for investigating industrial agriculture and other environmental problems as well, and I'm really excited to see how this turns out.
Excited and maybe a little bit scared, I wonder. I know you're probably going to face a lot of harassment, and I saw that farmers might perhaps threaten to shoot your drones.
That's absolutely right, and there has been that reluctance, I think, on my part as well. You know, once I saw this project was funded, it was exciting, but also like, oh my God, this is actually going to have to happen now. You know, when you're proposing this, it's kind of self-evident, but it becomes a reality, and then you have an obligation to do it. And, you know, I'm still really excited about the potential here, but I grew up in Texas, born and raised. I know the animosity that can exist between, people that are perceived as environmentalists or animal protection groups and farmers. I know that can lead to physical altercations, and also we've already seen online, like you said, this Kickstarter isn't even over, and people are already threatening to shoot down the drones. In a lot of ways, that makes me want to do the investigation even more, because if they're that concerned and it hasn't even been purchased yet, it makes me want to know what they're so terrified of being exposed. But it also, I think, is, some cause for alarm, and I'm going to be going about this safely and lawfully.
Awesome. Well, I wish you the best of luck. And I know your Kickstarter has a ways to go. You're about a third of the way to your goal, and there's 3 weeks left. The project will be funded on Wednesday, July 9th. So for people who want to donate that, make sure to do that right away in any amount. I'm sure it's all welcome. And there's some really cool prizes and rewards there. So yeah, I'll put a link on our website, of course.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
You are very welcome. And thank you for speaking with us today. Such an honor. And we hope to have you again on the show to check in and in a year or so and see how this drone project is going. It's very exciting.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. And keep up the great work. And I look forward to talking to you again soon.
You are listening to 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver's Co-op Radio, broadcasting live from Wall Street in the Vancouver area on unceded Coast Salish territories. That was Will Potter. He's a world-acclaimed and a celebrated investigative journalist and author of Green is the New Red, a social an insider's account of a social movement under siege, an excellent book. And I just wanted to thank Darren and Fireweed and Glenn and Risa for your support in helping to create that interview and make it happen. It feels lovely to feel that community support. So thank you so much for that. Because I was pretty nervous talking to Will, I have to admit, because I really look up to him and I think his work is awesome. Yeah, what did you think about the interview?
I thought it was a great interview. I really appreciate his drive and the fact, he says, do not have fear. We could be really fearful that as activists that we could go to jail. I mean, that's a real thing. But he's like, don't be fearful. You do the good work. And I just love his positivity and all that he sees that we need to. And I also love that he talked about intersectionality, that all the groups need to come together, not just environmentalists, not just animal rights people, but people working in all different struggles that we're all working against oppression. And I think that's been a huge kind of thing for me lately to really think about. And I really appreciate him talking about that.
Yeah, definitely. It's it is quite scary when you think that people are going to jail in the US mostly based on conspiracy charges. So they're just that they haven't even been proven to do anything illegal, just that they have ideas that are fairly radical and they want
to change the system. They want things to be better for the earth and for animals, and then they're charged with conspiracy and put in jail for a long time. It's really insane. And
I'm also really excited about his drone project, just because I remember just in Speciesism where they had the helicopter and they're just showing just the bird's eye view of the farms, and you could kind of, you know, see what was going on and see all the kind of spillage from the sewage and all that kind of stuff. And I think that kind of footage is really good for the public to see and whatever else he might uncover from these drones. So
yeah, definitely. So check that out on Kickstarter, his campaign, Will Potter Kickstarter. Just search for that. Just a couple little events coming up I wanted to mention. First of all, the Vancouver Veg Fest is coming up Saturday, July 26th, so make sure you mark your calendars for that. It's a full day-long event downtown Vancouver. And also...
Yeah, and then coming up soon, July 1st, is the Victoria Vegan Fest, and we're going to be there, Animal Voices, so you should come check us out. It's July 1st, as I said, and it's from 12 to 5 p.m., and it's absolutely free, and it's at the Marketplace in the heart of Victoria, and there will be speakers, entertainers, vegan businesses, lots of vegan food. I've never been, so I'm really excited that we're going to support this great event, and I love that it's called the Vegan Fest, which is awesome, because there's a lot of veg fest. They never add the vegan part, so it's lovely.
Mm. And they do say, though, all welcome, from veg curious to long-term vegan. They just want everyone to come check it out, learn something new, take, you know, there'll probably be some samples, lots of handouts and goodies and stuff. And just very quickly, Direct Action Everywhere, their group who started in 2013 in San Francisco just last year, they're coming on a little West Coast tour up from there. It has That movement, Direct Action Everywhere, has spread to 41 cities. Their campaign, It's Not Food, It's Violence, which attacks the humane myth, has proven to be very successful, and it's growing. And if you want to learn more about it, there'll be a demo on July 1st, and on July 2nd at 7 p.m., there's a learning evening. So check out directactioneverywhere.com to learn more.
So please join us next week. That's June 27th, where we'll be having another great show. We here at Animal Voices ask you to keep connected to us. You can connect to us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, via Twitter, Animal Voices YVR, and you can always send us your suggestions either on Facebook or email at us at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. And also check out our website, animalvoices.org, where you can download podcasts of our show. So we're going to be closing our show with the song.
It's a song by Propagandhi, which is one of Will Potter's favorite bands. They are a group based in Winnipeg. And the song is called Potemkin City Limits. It's about a pig who escaped a farm or a slaughterhouse and lived in a forest around the city for like 5 months until he was captured. And then they made a statue in his honor. I think probably he was killed after he was captured. So it's a pretty sad story, but it's still, you know, exciting. And I show solidarity with that pig who ran away and found freedom for 5 months. So here's Propagandhi.
Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices. And please remember to be kind to the animals.